Welcome to Politics Up Close here on KCBW. I'm Jeff Robinson. Overhauling the state's pension system for public employees might not be the type of challenge you'd normally expect a freshman lawmaker to take on, but former Republican State Senator Dan Lilienquist tackled the controversial task and later followed it up by reforming the state's Medicaid spending with bipartisan support. Now he's hoping to get Utah Republicans to notice his accomplishments as he runs for the U.S. Senate against a 36-year incumbent, Orrin Hatch. How does he plan to take on a lawmaker with $4 million in his campaign war chest? Dan Lilienquist joins me now in the studio to talk about why he's the alternative to Hatch this election year and how he plans to defeat him. Dan, it's great to have you here in the studio.
Jeff, great to be with you.
Listeners, join us on the air this morning with your questions and comments for former Senator Dan Lilienquist, a candidate for U.S. Senate. We're at 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. Senator, is this race something that you've had your eye on for a long time?
Jeff, my wife and I have been considering this for some time as we have looked at the challenges we face in the state of Utah. Particularly working in the legislature, you see how much the federal government dictates what we do as a state. And we've worked hard as a state to be self-sufficient, to move our state forward. And yet it seems at every turn the federal government is holding things up. And so, you know, it's time for a new generation of leaders to step up and to stand up for the state's rights and to make sure that we have the tools necessary to move the state forward.
So why go for a Senate? This may be the single most difficult office you could be running for instead of the House, for example. Why this particular seat held by Orrin Hatch?
Well, God bless Orrin Hatch for his decades of service to the state. I was 2 years old when he was elected. He will go down in history as one of the great ambassadors for this state. But elections really, Jeff, are about the future. And I've been looking for leadership, particularly on the financial issues of this country. You mentioned in your intro that in my time in the legislature, I've focused on the long-term structural problems we have in the state, pensions and Medicaid. And we've been successful in reforming those programs. But those similar programs federally are the programs that are chewing up every penny of our federal budget. And in my lifetime, we have not had leaders step up to say, we are going to solve these programs nationally. And that's what I intend to do.
So did you get into this race primarily because of what you see as the shortcomings of Senator Hatch, or was it a different reason?
You know, I think Orrin Hatch and I have a difference of opinion as to what the role of a United States senator is. One thing that came out this week that's evidence of that. We worked 2 years ago in 2010 to reform our state pension system. We looked down the road, saw it was unsustainable in the path we were on, and made some changes with bipartisan support to change the system. Well, just this week alone, Orrin Hatch came out with a press release saying that he was now going to pass national legislation to reform state and local pensions. And I just think, wait a second, that's not the role. That's not your job, Orrin, to come into the state of Utah after we've fixed the problem and say, you know, I'm going to come up with a solution for the state of Utah. You know, so it's just kind of an interesting thing. I'm trying to figure out how his philosophy differs from mine. That's one key way I look and say, wait a second, states can handle their own problems. We have plenty of federal problems that I'd love to have him turn his attention to. We just differ on a variety of things along those lines.
This is Politics Up Close on KCBW. My guest is former Republican State Senator Dan Lilienquist, who recently resigned from the legislature to challenge U.S. Senator Orrin Hatch. Our phone number this morning is 801-355-TALK, 801-355-8255. We welcome your questions and comments. And, Dan, how difficult was it to decide to get into this race, considering the various factors? One, this incumbent has, as I said, $4 million in the bank. Two, I believe you have 6 children who are all 12 years old or younger. I mean, that must have been challenging.
Well, by far, the biggest consideration has been our family. My wife, Brooke, and I have 6 young kids. I actually love being a dad. I love being with my children. And that's what took us so long. We thought about it. We spent a lot of time contemplating the decision. But it came down to it. Each one of my children have $50,000 of federal debt on their head before they begin reliving their life. And we are burning through money at such a rate that I worry about their opportunity. And I feel like I can add to the debate, particularly around the big structural reforms we need around entitlement reform and welfare reform, that I felt like if I'm going to have a future for my kids, I've got to do something. Now, we're going to raise our children. We're going to stay right here in Bountiful, Utah. Well, we live in Bountiful, and I'm going to go back to Washington and then come home on the weekends to be with my family. But we're just trying to work through the balance to make sure that when I'm home, I'm home, and try to figure out how to be both a dad and a public servant.
What about the daunting task of actually, you know, defeating this well-funded incumbent? How was that a factor in your decision?
No, because, not really. I mean, a race like this, particularly the way Washington works these days with $3 billion a year spent on lobbying, because the federal government gives out so much money, I'm not surprised at all that, a 36-year incumbent has millions and millions of dollars, 97% of it coming from out of state into his campaign. But the real difference is I don't think our delegate process can be bought. I think the people of the state balance out that kind of spending with volunteerism. In fact, in our 1 week after we announced, we've had over 400 volunteers reach out to us, and we're picking up more every day. So we will combat the money with a grassroots message. We are raising money, and we think we'll be effective. But I think what the people of the state of Utah are saying, and I hear it consistently, is God bless Orrin, but it's time. It's time for him to come home, and it's time for a new generation to step up.
Do you worry that this campaign, with so much support, as you said, so many volunteers coming in, do you worry that it's going to be more about people campaigning against Orrin Hatch rather than it is people campaigning for you, if you know what I mean?
Well, I hope not. And so far, no. We've been positive. I respect the man. I think he's been a good senator for the state of Utah. He'll go down in history as one of our greats. He's served longer than anybody else. He's taken us to new heights. But the issues that I'm interested in are the issues around spending and entitlement reform and these things that I care about and that I ran for office to fix. I'm going to have to live through the next 40 years of this country, Jeff. I'm extremely motivated to find solutions that make it so that my family can have similar opportunities that I've had. And so that's what I'm determined to do. We are running a positive race and bringing our message to the people that, I have a record of actually getting substantive change done, change that not only has affected the state of Utah, but as a model to the country. I went to 16 states last year helping them on pension reform, including Rhode Island, who just passed a significant, earth-shattering reform, really, in a very blue state. They reformed their pension program, and I worked hand-in-hand with Gina Raimondo, the treasurer, who drove that reform there. So the models, the ideas we've had here in the state that we've been successful passing, the legislation that I've run, I'm confident that we can come up with new ideas to come up with bipartisan solutions in Washington to the seemingly intractable problems we face as a country.
So, Dan, we're going to take a call in just a second here. But before we do that, tell me a bit about your business background, where you come from before you first ran for the legislature.
Well, sure. My training, I was an economics major at BYU and then have a law degree from the University of Chicago, but never practiced law. I went and worked with Bain Consulting out of law school. And my time there at Bain and in subsequent times in Fortune 500 world, which I spent a few years there, I did turnaround work on businesses where businesses were struggling. I would go in and help them figure out where they could do better, how to turn their business around and get them back on track. And that was one of the reasons why I ran for the legislature. If you look, the state of Utah spends $12 billion a year. That's a Fortune 500 size business if you compare it to other businesses out there. And so that's where I've turned my focus to here. It's been a lot of fun.
And our number is 801-355-TALK, 801-355-8255. Jordan is on the line from Salt Lake City. Jordan, what's your question or comment for Dan Lilienquist?
Yeah, I know that Dan reformed pensions in Utah, as he's been talking about. I just kind of want to know his view on pension for legislators, because I think that a lot of legislators get treated very nicely with their pensions, especially at the federal level.
All right, good question, Jordan. What are your thoughts, Dan?
Jordan, good question. I don't think legislators should have a better deal than anybody else. In fact, when we ran our pension reform legislation, when I carried that bill in 2010, mm-hmm. I don't think people realize that we ended pensions for legislators in the state of Utah. Now, the current legislators have a property right. We can't change that. But we ended prospectively pensions for legislators. We're a citizen legislature. We don't need pensions. And so we should not be asking any public employee to make a sacrifice that the legislature is not willing to make, you know, twice over. And so I think that attitude actually helped us as we ran those reforms, that we were not trying to preserve a sweetheart deal for the legislators. And I also worked with Representative Dugal last year to address the very rich health care benefit the legislators get. After 10 years of service above 65, they get, you know, health care for life basically on the taxpayer dime. And I think we'll have the votes in the legislature this year to overturn that as well. Legislators should lead by example. And federally, some of the pension programs that Congress get are far better than anybody else gets. They don't participate in Social Security. They have their own deal. And if you serve, you know, decades in the U.S. Senate, you know, you get a six-figure pension when you retire. And, you know, I just don't – nobody else gets that. I think that's something we should address, as we've done in Utah.
All right, Jordan, we appreciate your call very much. Going back to the phones again here, Linda, also calling from Salt Lake City. What is your question or comment for Senator Dan Lundquist?
My question is about your views on the effect on our economy of the spending on the wars we're involved in.
All right. Good question, Linda. Your thoughts on war spending in Afghanistan and Iraq or wherever it may be. Senator, too high, too low? What are your thoughts?
You know, when you go to war, it's extremely expensive. You know, that's where treasure of every civilization in history has been sucked up in war. And when we go to war as a country, we need to be very, very careful and very clear that our objectives are clear, that we get in, get out, and to get the job done. You know, going into Iraq and Afghanistan at the time, about 10 years ago, over 10 years ago, or at least Afghanistan, you know, there seemed to be a very clear and present danger to the United States, and I think there was. And so we needed to act. The trick is, when do you come home? And I think personally it's time to come home. We have met our mission from where I'm standing. I don't have all the intelligence, but it's time to come home. We need a strong military. My concern about not only our military spending is our overall spending. Currently, we're borrowing every penny of our defense spending, every penny, because the rest of our budget is taken up with other programs. And we need to look across the board and reevaluate across the board what we're doing as a country to get things back on track. But certainly, in my opinion, from where I'm sitting and getting the data I have, I think it's time to come home.
Linda, thank you for the call. You can still join us on the air at 801-355-TALK. That's 355-8255. We'll take a few more calls a little bit later on in our interview. We're speaking with former Republican State Senator Dan Lillienquist. He recently resigned from the legislature to challenge U.S. Senator Orrin Hatch this election year. So, Senator, as we've talked about, you were well known in the legislature first for reforming the state's pension system for public employees. That was only, I think, your second legislative session you accomplished that. What's your strategy for, you know, getting the clout to get something like that done when perhaps a more senior lawmaker might want to, you know, take your idea and run it himself?
Well, you know, it's interesting. When I got elected, I felt like I was elected to do something, and I was on the committee that pension issue should be addressed on. And when I start running, you know, taking that bill and moving it forward, I had a colleague come and literally pat me on the head and say, you know, you need more seniority before you do this. You need to wait around and spend more time. And I just thought, you know, well, no. I'm here. It's in front of us. We can do something, and I move forward. And I, to the credit of my colleagues, I tracked them all down. I went and met with each one of them individually, explained the problem, why we had to do what we had to do, and we built. It took us a year. It took me a year really to lay this out, these facts out. But eventually, when my colleagues really understood where we were going and the problems we had, they came along. I think passion, energy, and really getting into the data and making these issues, which they're not partisan issues, making them about reality. There really are reality issues that you can build consensus around ideas and moving forward, whether you've been there, you know, a week or been there 40 years. So, you know, I think that can be done. We did that not only on pensions, did the same process on Medicaid. Be objective about where we're going. Really look at the trade-offs we'll have to make and not make this about ideology but about reality. And I think that, you know, again, passion, energy, drive overcomes seniority every time.
Now, having covered the pension reform bill back in 2010, I recall, you know, a lot of public employees being very upset with the final legislation and testifying during the committee meetings. And I don't think most Democrats voted for the legislation as well. Do you think you did the best you could sort of getting everybody on board there?
You know, one of the best experiences I had, and, you know, it was difficult. We were saying, you know, by the way, I just make it clear, we are committed to meet every penny of the pension obligations we've made to current
right.
and retirees. To do that, we had to do a couple of things. One, we had to have new people come on a different deal. And we made that as generous as we felt we could make it. And I think the public would say a 10% contribution on top of Social Security into a retirement plan, a 10% of your income, is a pretty good plan. But we also said at the end, and I think it made people a little bit upset, that this is a retirement program. It was never meant to be a program where you retire, and I say that in quotes, on a Friday at one state job and then come back on Monday at another.
Double dipping,
and
right.
Yeah. And so we said we've got to address that, and we pulled we changed the post-retirement reemployment rules and said, look, this really needs to be a retirement system. We did that, Jeff. Because our state, our auditors came and said that double-dipping practice would cost the state of Utah, just for about a couple thousand, 3,000 or so employees, almost $1 billion over the next 10 years. And given all the other challenges we have with funding education, et cetera, we just said, look, we can't afford to do that, and so we're going to change that piece. So it was a little bit contentious, but my favorite part was when we finished it. We never hid the ball. We always were open about what we were trying to do, and there was nothing hidden in the legislation. And I got a call from one of the leaders of one of the police unions in the state on the night the bill passed, and he just said, Dan, I want you to know that when you run for reelection, every single one of us are behind you because you were open and you were honest with us. We may have disagreed with the result, but you didn't make us the villains, and this was an attempt to get to the right solution as a state. That was great. And so, you know, since then, my relationships with these groups have been very, very good. I'm certainly just trying to make sure that the state of Utah 10, 20, 30 years from now is in a good place.
We need to take a quick break. We're speaking with Dan Lilienquist. He is a candidate for the U.S. Senate, a Republican candidate. You can join us on the air at 801-355-TALK, 801-355-8255. We'll be right back with more Politics Up Close here on KCBW. You're listening to Politics Up Close here on NPR Utah, KCBW. I'm Jeff Robinson, joined in the studio by State Senator Dan Lilienquist, who recently resigned from the legislature to become a candidate for U.S. Senate. Our phone number this morning is 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. We welcome your questions and comments for Dan this morning. And Chris, you are on the line. What is your question or comment? All right, it looks like we are missing Chris, so we will go instead to Bob. Bob, you are on the line with former State Senator Dan Lilienquist. What's your question?
Actually, it's...
Larry, I apologize.
There you go. I didn't want to interrupt Bob.
Go ahead.
I've had a real estate investment company in Salt Lake for the last 40 years, and... you consider now we're 12% gross tax on our property. We're 10% tax on all utilities. And inflation is killing us. Like a faucet that might cost $100 now is $200. Well, that tax now is 14%, not 7%. And some of our rents haven't changed for 15 years. The city, all the city license and stuff and all that stuff has doubled. About everything has doubled in price. We figured it up the other day. If we'd had a lot of that tax money to invest, would be worth $200 million today.
All right, Larry, we appreciate the call. So, Senator, talking about feeling overtaxed, any plans for that there in Washington?
Well, I felt a little overtaxed today, and I don't want to disparage the good city of Salt Lake, but when I went out to the parking meter today, my quarter, instead of buying 15 minutes, bought 10 minutes, so a 50% increase in the parking meters. Look, I think the frustration that Larry just highlighted is, when is there an end to taxes? When do they become predictable? And when do businesses... it's a very real cost to them, not only from making payroll day to day, but also the opportunity cost of a $200 million hit over the lifetime of his business where he could be investing and growing. I think we're all okay with having government do the basics and do things that, you know, keep the roads clean, make sure there are roads, making sure that we are safe, et cetera. But I think what we're sensing is frustration as a country is that we feel like we're taxed enough already, that there's you know, we're having to make sacrifices privately in our own business, et cetera. And yet it seems like government too often says we are not going to make the changes we need to make to be streamlined and more efficient, and instead we're going to go and make you pay for it. That's why I think there's been support for things like pension reform in this state.
Mm-hmm.
What was interesting to me as we did this thing, it was very unpopular with state workers at the time. But by the fall of 2010, the vast majority of Utahns said, I mean, that was the number one issue that really changed people's decisions on elections that fall. And we, you know, four or five people who voted against the pension reform were voted out of office. And it's just been kind of interesting to see. I think the general public are saying it's enough. We do not have a taxation problem. We have a spending problem. And you cannot go, how far are you going to go deeper and deeper into the wallets of the taxpaying public to fund programs that are unsustainable? And I think people are ready for change.
Larry, we appreciate your call. We have to move on. And Chris is back on the line. What is your question or comment for Dan Lillenquist?
Yeah, I know with pension reform here in Utah, that was something that we were able to move the ball forward with at a national level and state level. It's a tough issue, and I understand that there's a hole in the budget here in Utah. I'm just wondering about the challenges that you might face in reforming it at the national level with the fiscal challenges that the reform has faced here in the state.
All right, so taking what you've done on the state level to the federal level, probably a difficult task with all the personalities there in Washington.
Well, if there's anything that's on our side here, Jeff, and Chris, it's reality. Reality is on our side here. We have no money. And I was on a plane when I saw the USA Today report. I was flying back from Florida after meeting with their legislature. I saw the USA Today report that said that there's a $5.7 trillion unfunded federal pension liability. That over the years, if you add that up, you know, there's 10 million federal workers. The $5.7 trillion unfunded federal workers, the entire Social Security unfunded liability for everybody else is $6.5 trillion, only 20%, you know, 30% more than that number. And so, you know, I think the federal workers have got to be concerned as well about their pension status. And I think, you know, the first things first is what we've done over the years is we've invested, and I say that loosely, we've invested proceeds, or we've invested the pension contributions for federal workers into treasuries, which then we turned right around and spent the cash out of the treasury. And so, you know, there's a variety of things we need to do to diversify holdings and actually put that money in a place where the government or the Congress can't turn right around and spend it. And that's what's happened over the years. It happened with the Social Security Trust Fund, with the pension trust funds for federal workers, is that Congress spent the money. Because we put them only really into treasuries, and then we turned right around and spent the money. You've got to start creating real asset bases that are not just federal treasuries if you want to turn these programs around.
Chris, thank you for the call. 801-355-TALK is our phone number this morning. Talking with former State Senator Dan Lillenquist, a candidate for U.S. Senate running against longtime incumbent Orrin Hatch. Turning now to your Medicaid reform bill of 2011, Senator Lillenquist, and how you've kind of made Medicaid part of your campaign. I saw something you posted on Facebook that said Medicaid should be a safety net, not a luxury hammock. I think some people might take issue with the idea that Medicaid is kind of a luxury hammock. What are you trying to say there?
Well, it's interesting. You're right in that much of Medicaid is not a luxury hammock. In fact, it's pretty awful. When I was first elected to the legislature, my first day on the job, I had to sit down on a committee and look our disabled and mental illness communities in the eye and say, we're cutting your budget.
Right.
Not for lack of funding to Medicaid. In fact, we were putting millions and millions more into Medicaid. But it was going to a portion of Medicaid, the fee-for-service side of Medicaid, the hospital and doctor and pharmaceutical side of Medicaid, mm-hmm. that it was growing so fast it was crushing all of our other investment. And when I say Medicaid, it really is, on the insurance side, the best insurance money cannot buy, because you don't put a penny towards premium. The copays at the emergency room are $6, and nobody collects them, because if it is an emergency, they're required by law to track you down and give you your $6 back. And we started realizing that our utilization in hospitals and emergency departments and other things were blowing up, because the incentives were misaligned. And you know who hurt the most? Our disabled and our mental illness communities. Now, we went and looked at that and said, no, we've got to change it. We worked for a year. We brought in all the advocacy groups. We brought in all the partners to say, what do we do? Because mm-hmm. Medicaid is the great Pac-Man of our budget. It is eating through everything we do. In fact, if you look at higher ed and public education growth in the budget this year, Medicaid and Children's Health Insurance, CHIP, are eating up more than the growth in those programs, and more than the growth in public and higher ed combined. And so we just said, look, we've got to take this section of Medicaid and reform it. And we got together and we came up with a bill. We were moving the fee-for-service side to a managed care environment, and we capped the growth in the state budget. Part of that is so that we can afford to take care of our disabled and our mental illness communities, our substance abuse communities, because that's what Medicaid was designed to do in the first place. It was meant to be a safety net to catch people when they're down, to help them get on their feet moving forward. But on the insurance side, it is so lucrative that we have a lot of people dropping private insurance or choosing not to marry or doing other things so they can qualify for it. And we just can't afford that portion of Medicaid as it's formulated. So we passed a bill to change it, and we passed it unanimously. Every Democrat, every Republican, the governor signed it, and the federal government is holding up that waiver right now because we are asking copays on a free healthcare program to go from $3 to $5 for an office visit.
Are you worried then that if that waiver isn't granted by Health and Human Services, that this could all be for naught?
Well, we have to have it, because our alternatives are over the next decade, by 2020, Medicaid will grow from 21% of our budget, where it is now, it could be as high as 46% of our budget. We simply cannot afford that. Our choices will be to either dramatically raise taxes, and by the way, it just doesn't stop at 2020, it keeps going, keeps growing, or we close down the University of Utah, Utah State, and another higher ed institution, or we lay off thousands of school teachers. There is no other way to get this money. We have to have this waiver. And and because we have to, we're going to keep pushing till we get it, because we have no other choice. This is an area that's out of control of our budget.
Dan, we have just a few minutes left here, so let's talk a little bit more about the campaign. You have been hitting the road ever since you made your official announcement. I think yesterday you were in four different counties throughout the state. How many campaign events did you have this week alone?
Oh, boy. This week, you know what? That's Jeff, you put me on the spot. I think we had to have had over 10. We have town halls every night. We were out in Price. We were in Davis County on Tuesday night, Price on Wednesday night. We're in San Pete County and Juab County, Utah County, and Salt Lake County yesterday. And tonight we're down in Orem for another town hall meeting. And then we have our big kickoff campaign event Saturday night. So it's been busy, but it's a lot of fun. I'm having a great time. The response has been overwhelmingly positive, and respectful of the good senator, but people saying, it's time, and it's time to tackle the issues that you've been tackling here on a federal level.
So how do you go about campaigning for the GOP nomination at the state convention when the delegates haven't even been picked yet? That probably makes it a little more difficult.
Well, you know, it's interesting. There are connectors in every place, people who are active and involved in politics in every county. And we are meeting those people, and we're also meeting existing state delegates, which oftentimes run to be new state delegates, and we're recruiting a whole new group of people who have never been involved who are excited to be involved. You know, one of them is my neighbor who came to me and said, "Hey, I've been watching reruns of The West Wing, you know, the old NBC program," and he said, and I really want to get involved. And it's been kind of fun, and, you know, that good friend of mine has made hundreds of phone calls in the last couple of weeks. So it's been fun. We're getting a whole new group of people involved for the first time, and then we're also getting around to meeting people who have been involved for years. And the response from both sides has been very good.
Now, as you know, in order to win right at the convention, you have to get 60% of the delegates. If you don't, and if this were to go to a primary election, do you think you would have the resources still to win, you know, when you have to campaign in front of all the voters of the whole state?
Yeah, I do. We're raising money. We're being successful at doing that. But where we are going to be successful is with a whole bunch of people out there talking to their neighbors and emailing. I had one guy come to my event last night. By the time I got home from the event, he wasn't on my team until he left the event. And by the time I got home, I had an email from him saying, "I've emailed every member of my family telling them we need to support you." It's going to be, you know, we were having that happen all over the place. It's going to be that. You know, I think that this is a small state. We have one media market. I think we'll be competitive in a primary, but I also think we'll be successful in a convention battle.
And finally, Dan, to end our interview on a personal note, I think I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you a little bit about you know, something, well-known event back in 2008. You were in a plane crash in Guatemala. You were on a humanitarian mission there, and many people who you were with on that plane died, and you survived. And in fact, just a couple months later, was in the Utah legislature. How do you carry that with you, and does it affect what you do on the campaign trail at all?
You know, well, it always kind of goes with me. I have a really bad ankle, and you know, so days like this, when the weather changes, it starts to swell. But you know, given the alternative, I'm pretty lucky guy. I lost four dear friends on the plane, but there are other people on the plane. In fact, last night, Jeff, a woman came to my town hall in South Jordan and came up to me afterward and said, "You know, my best friend, her brother was on that plane, and he was the father of a family of four from Wisconsin. The father and son died, and the mother and daughter were the other two survivors out of the 14 on the plane." And you know, obviously, I get a little emotional on that. I don't talk about it much because I don't think it's relevant from a policy standpoint, et cetera. But for me, it's taught me a couple of things. One, life is short. I don't feel like I have time to wait around to try to do something. And maybe that, I don't know, it's hard to psychoanalyze yourself, but maybe that was part of the impetus for me just jumping in on some of these issues. But I do feel an urgency to make my life and my service count. And in some ways, you know, I feel like I owe that to my friends. So, but I'm grateful to be alive. It's nice to have another shot at life. You know, I want to make my life count.
We've been speaking with former State Senator Dan Lilienquist. He is a candidate for the U.S. Senate running against Orrin Hatch this election year. And Senator Lilienquist, we very much appreciate the time you've given us this morning and look forward to speaking with you further as this campaign progresses. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeff.
This is Politics Up Close here on KCBW. I'm Jeff Robinson, and we'll be right back with Salt Lake City Mayor Ralph Becker.